Thanks so much, Hamilton, for that introduction. And thank you, everyone, for joining me here today. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land we're meeting on, the Kaurna people, to pay respect to elders past, present and emerging, and to extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders here today. Well, thank you. I'm here to talk to you about two trade agreements that my team are currently putting through what we call the treaty process. Those are the Hong Kong Free Trade Agreement and its associated investment agreement, and also the Indonesia-Australia Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. But perhaps what I can do is just provide you with a bit of a framework for those negotiations, talk to you about what we're doing at the moment and a little bit about what's inside both of those negotiations. That's quite a bit, actually. I'll try and speak for 20 minutes. If I speak beyond that, please let me know and we can start doing something else. Let's start with Hong Kong. The Hong Kong agreement was a negotiation that didn't take very much time in the greater scheme of things for free trade agreements. It took us about a year and a half to negotiate, which is probably an all-time record for any negotiation. People ask me two questions about the Hong Kong negotiation. The first question they ask me is, we've got a free trade agreement with China, why are we negotiating with Hong Kong? And the answer to that, of course, is that in 1997, when an arrangement was struck with the United Kingdom for a transitional period before Hong Kong became part of China, it had its own constitution, as it were. It's called the Basic Law, and the Basic Law gives Hong Kong total responsibility for matters commercial, but shared responsibility for other things. For instance, shared responsibility for investment. So when we negotiated our agreement with China, it didn't include anything that happened in Hong Kong. So we felt that given the extent of the relationship between Australia and Hong Kong, given the fact that it is Australia's second largest business community outside of Australia, 100,000 Australians live in Hong Kong. There are 600 Australian businesses in Hong Kong, and there are 14 Australia-Hong Kong chambers of some sort or another in Hong Kong. So it's a pretty big deal. This was a gap that was worth exploring. Not only that, but, you know, Hong Kong, obviously we've had long-time links with Hong Kong. It's really the hub for that whole North Asian region, and it's the sort of market that Australians go to explore whether they want to do Asia. So it's a great testing pad for us. And while it is an open market, and it's prided itself on being an open market, the only black letter law trade relationship we've had with Hong Kong was when Hong Kong joined the World Trade Organization in the year 2000, during which, despite the fact that it is an open port and all of Australia's goods travel into Hong Kong under a zero tariff, during which time in the World Trade Organization, they only locked in 52.3% of their tariff schedule. So actually what that meant was for everything else, they were allowed to impose a tariff of any degree, and that would be totally legal for them to do. So while our expectation is that Hong Kong prides itself on not being that sort of an economy, it was important to lock that in to a free trade agreement. But really, this was a negotiation that was about services and investment. That's what defines us. It's those professional services that are in Hong Kong that really are the bedrock of Australia's profile in Hong Kong. And so that was the focus of the negotiation. For me, as I say, this is an open economy. And really, this was a meeting of minds, you know, two very like-minded sort of economies sitting together on either side of a negotiating table. For me, the key outcome, which is gold for Australia, is the outcome that was delivered in the e-commerce chapter. So just to give you a little bit of a sense of what these FTAs look like for those of you who not totally comfortable with how these things look. There are a bunch of legal rules that both economies agree, or multiple economies, if it's a regional agreement, agree to abide by. And then there are market access schedules. So this is divided into goods, where you negotiate on tariff barriers. And in services, the focus is on locking in current levels of openness, so that there's no opportunity to unwind the sort of environment in which businesses operate. So the e-commerce chapter was one of those legal chapters, and the take-home outcome for this agreement was the agreement that data should flow freely across borders. And its associated rule, which is obviously extremely important, is to allow businesses the opportunity to choose where they store their data. So many countries in the world actually prescribe that an investor needs to store their data in that country. And there's all sorts of concerns of one sort or another associated with that. So in this agreement, we were able to agree that any investor in goods, services should be allowed to store their data wherever they feel free, wherever they so choose, be that the cloud or, you know, in another economy. And for the first time in any free trade agreement between any party around the world, that rule was extended to the financial services sector. And you can imagine the sort of financial interests between Australia and Hong Kong are very extensive, so this is quite an important outcome. The other outcomes worthy of note, particularly in a South Australian community here, is on the wine sector. Now, while we didn't spend a lot of time negotiating the tariff schedule, in fact, it was probably the shortest negotiation of all time. We just said zero, zero, done, which was marvellous, and usually there's blood all over the floor with that particular exercise. But we add an annex to the technical barriers to trade chapter, which was about wine labelling. This was particularly at the request of our wine industry. Hong Kong has become increasingly important as a wine hub for the region. What this wine annex does is that it stipulates certain pieces of information that goes on a wine label. And what that means, if you boil it all down, is that wine producers can standardise the label into multiple markets. It's basically a huge, huge saving for them to be able to say, you know, for these 10 countries, we've just got this one label that we put on this thing. Originally, this was an agreement that we did among 5 or 6 wine-producing countries, this agreement. There's this group called the World Wine Trade Group. And it's sort of, they're mainly New World wine producers, if I can put it like that. And we've all agreed that we will have this standard approach to labelling. And then slowly, as we've done our free trade agreements, we've tried to put this, particularly where we have big big buyers of Australian wine, we try and get them to buy onto that particular product so that it's really a huge cost saving for our wine exporters. The other big outcomes, I guess, and this is probably equally right across Australia, were the professional services outcomes. While this isn't new access per se, again, it locks into law the sort of access that our accountants, engineers, architects, bookkeepers, auditors have into the Hong Kong economy. Perhaps I should leave that now. There are also outcomes on education that we can talk about, and there are outcomes, a few outcomes on investment that might be worth teasing out when we have our chat later on. But perhaps if I could move on to Indonesia, a very different negotiation. Both of these outcomes so important in their own regard. This negotiation started in 2013, went through several boom and bust cycles, and finally was concluded and signed in March this year, as was the Hong Kong agreement. This one, it was very interesting to me. Actually, I kind of, this is my adoptive child, really. I received this one recently to take through the treaty process along with Hong Kong. This one was really, the focus for this was one of trying to create a look of mutual economic benefit. This was the first time that Indonesia had really done a very detailed bilateral agreement. It's done several negotiations in the context of its ASEAN membership, including with Australia previously. But this time, a bilateral deal, and there was a great deal of nervousness on the Indonesian side. So we've worked very carefully. We collected up a business partnership arrangement between Indonesian and Australian stakeholders. On our side, the Australia-Indonesia Business Council and ACCI, the Australian Council of Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and on the Indonesian side, KADIN, and also the counterpart to the AIBC, which is the IABC, the Indonesia-Australia Business Council. And they got together and they formulated some ideas that would create the balance that we needed that would allow the Indonesian government to take this agreement forward. Now, on the good side of the negotiation was a very sensitive part of the negotiation for Indonesia, because they're relatively protectionist in sentiment, and they have been forever. And that was very difficult for us. And that obviously, number one priority for Australia is to get good preferential access, particularly for our agriculture sector, which so long has been subject to the whims of gigantic subsidies around the world. So FTAs is a place where we really try to drive our agenda for the agriculture sector. We were successful in doing so. 99% of Australian goods will flow to Indonesia either under a zero tariff arrangement or significantly better preferential arrangements. For the most sensitive items, we put in place some quotas, and this will be, we're just currently trying to set up how that exactly is going to work once we have both ratified the agreement. For Indonesia, their goods will travel into Australia under a zero tariff from entry into force of the agreement. we really, on the services and investment side of the negotiation, tried to pick up this idea that was given to us by both the Indonesian government and with the backing of this business partnership arrangement of a powerhouse for Indonesia. And that is choosing those services sector in particular that where Australia has great strengths that Indonesia is looking to improve, where they're looking to improve, and I'm talking about education, I'm talking about healthcare, I'm talking about the METS sector, the mining and engineering sector, aged care, those sort of areas, and really focusing in on those areas. So it was sort of a narrower group of services outcomes in this agreement, but mindfully so. And some of the outcomes which don't cure some of the problems and challenges that our investors face in entering Indonesia, but provide a springboard and an openness for a conversation and a preferred partner status that will really assist in moving forward to allow our tertiary education sector, particularly the work training, as the first port of call to establish campuses for Australian certification of those vocational subjects to be accepted in Indonesia and for Australian trainers to be able to train in Indonesia. So those things are all new for Indonesia. For universities, there are still numbers of barriers, but there are some very lively conversations. President Jokowi has been very clear that he is looking to improve the quality of education in Indonesia and is looking to Australia to provide some assistance. Maybe that's enough for now, and maybe we can use that as a basis for some conversation. I can talk endlessly, of course, but that's probably less valuable than you asking questions. Thanks.